Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with attorney James Reedy from Sheehan Finney Bass & Green, and we're going to be talking about watery eyes, slurred speech, and Dorito crumbs. We must be talking about the latest approaches to drug and alcohol testing in the workplace and the legal challenges for employers. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Jim Reedy, attorney and chair of the Labor and Employment Law Group at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. And of course, an amazing, fantastic, wonderful just guy. How are you, Jim?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Great to be back.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about an interesting topic today, and I'll actually use the title you sent me, which is Watery Eyes, Slurred Speech, and Dorito Crumbs. Latest approaches to drug and alcohol testing in the workplace and the legal challenges for employers. Jim, are we going to be talking about toke breaks instead of smoke breaks now? Is that what we're going to be doing?
Well, if we do, we'll be talking about probably what will be a reality in the workplace in 3 to 5 years if we continue on the current course.
Well, you know, it's a brave new world, and this is one of those topics that I know there's some federal parts of this, and then there's really state parts of this, because there's so many different things happening in this area. So why don't you give us an overview of the landscape today, and then we'll get into the detail.
Sure. So I think if you had to poll most HR professionals, they would say in some way, shape, or form, they forbid the use or distribution of drugs and alcohol in the workplace, and to another level they say things like, and also you can't be impaired at work, whether it's prescription drugs, illicit drugs, or alcohol. And so in varying ways, most employers have some form of a drug and alcohol policy. The reality is that things have changed, and really in the last 10 to 15 years we've seen a pretty significant change in the workplace, and that is the number of companies that are testing for drugs and alcohol, those that are required to or those that choose to, the increase in number of people that are testing positive, and sometimes it's fueled by or belief that the rise in marijuana use and prescription drug use, and then issues associated with some states, as you say, are changing their laws. And there are more than 30 states now that have approved medical marijuana. And then I think there are now 4 states that approve recreational marijuana and the District of Columbia. That goes beyond decriminalizing marijuana. That is, you can have, for recreational use and for sale, marijuana. So it's similar to alcohol in that regard, that it's legal.
When you say legal, is it not still true that under federal law, it is still illegal?
And there is the rub. So whether we're talking about medical marijuana in some 30 states or the states that also have recreational marijuana, and when the employer goes to insist upon their drug policy, drug or alcohol policy, but more particularly their drug policy, and say, we do not permit people that if we test and find marijuana in your system, then you're subject to discipline or even termination or not getting hired. And the challenge to that is, but wait, I have a prescription from my physician, or it's legal to imbibe on the weekend. And the response is, and consistently now in the courts still, yeah, but we rely on federal law. And under federal law, it is still considered to be an illegal substance and therefore not protected. There have been cases in Michigan, Rhode Island, and a few other states that it actually has been upheld that the employer relying upon federal law can still insist that that is an illegal or prohibited substance.
So let's talk about that for just a little bit more, because I want to make sure, you know, people are out there saying, well, why do I have to allow it, even if the state says it, but it's federally illegal? You know, is there really a case to be made for an employer to stay firm with the federal law if, in fact, they're going to write a policy or they're going to, you know, say, this is what it is going to be at my workplace, come hell or high water?
Absolutely. So you have a situation where you were talking about a blue-collar environment where people are using heavy equipment. You're in a manufacturing environment where people are using fine tools, where you are in a sort of a mid-chain organization where someone is refining a product, mixing chemicals, mixing a recipe of some sort, or someone's performing surgery or delicate technical work. You would want that person not to be impaired because of the public policy, safety, and quality of products that we want to insist upon.
So we've talked a little bit about that part of it, but one other part that has come up, how about in the public domain, police, fire, governmental agencies? You know, because that's a very interesting twist when you're talking state law and federal law.
Well, I think that in that regard, certainly, I mean, if law enforcement or EMT or fire is to be at their highest and best game, because again, their job is to protect the public, can you insist that they refrain from and not test positive for certain substances? And the answer is absolutely. Here's the problem, whether we're talking about public or private domain, government or business, the problem with right now, you can test the impairment level with alcohol. You can determine whether someone has opiates in their system, amphetamines in their system, or other chemicals and the like, but it's hard to determine at this point what a level of impairment is with regard to marijuana. And the issue in that regard is the marijuana today is much, much more potent than it was, say, in the 70s and 80s. And it's either altered or enhanced in the process. But still, there is no way to determine a level of impairment. Two states, Washington and Colorado, have been looking at, based upon sampling, and it's a nano sample, to determine a level of impairment, and they're coming up with a standard. But it certainly isn't uniform yet, and it hasn't been legally tested.
Well, there is certainly a question about that. I've done a little reading on that and the question of whether they can actually take bodily fluids or different ways to get that sample, in terms of either swiping some saliva or you know, some other blood or something. That's an interesting part when you're talking about, it's not like an alcohol test we can just blow into a tube, right? I mean, there are other privacy concerns you could argue in those types of situations.
Yeah, so let's back up for just a second, and I think that a couple of things that come up with regard to alcohol and drugs in the workplace before we even get to testing. Some of the statistics that have come out recently are that 68.9% of all illicit drug users are over age 18, and 15.4 million of them were employed either full-time or part-time. So it's almost 70% of the illicit drug users over age 18 were actually employed in either a full-time or part-time capacity. Marijuana remains the most widely illicit drug, although, as we're seeing in the news almost every day, heroin is catching up because of its availability and because of its tie to the opiate addiction, which is so widespread. And that there was another statistic that came out that showed that 6.4% or 7.3 million Americans who are working on a full-time basis, ages 18 to 64, used marijuana in the last month. And that number has increased in the last couple of years. So pot is still number one, and it's rising. And so you think, okay, so what happens in those states where it's approved on a medical marijuana or on a recreational basis? Believe it or not, companies have not capitulated. They haven't given up saying, why test? Everyone's going to be positive. They've actually increased threefold the number of tests in Washington and Colorado just in the last year and a half.
Well, they're certainly looking at, you know, we have a situation where it's legal, and so, but I have to protect my workforce, right? I have to protect my other members of my team or my organization and the liability that comes along with this. I mean, we all know that these drugs affect individual in terms of how they perform, right?
Right. So statistics bear out that and this comes from SHRM statistics, people who abuse drugs and alcohol take more time off. They're either absent late or they leave early. They're less productive during the workday. They represent an increased risk of or cause of workplace accidents, and they may be the cause of increased workers' compensation costs or insurance premiums. So there's a real hard cost to the organization.
Don't they also are less likely to stay at a job and hop around a little?
Sure. In fact, a couple more studies came out said that illicit drug users more than their non-using peers are reported to have more than three jobs in the last year. So jumping from job to job, and whether it's because of discipline issues, attendance issues, failure to focus, or the like, or just their whatever the reason is, they're more mobile, they're less reliable, and so on.
You know, so HR has been talking about this for years, but it's becoming more and more of a real problem. In your research and what you've seen, you know, are HR professionals really concerned about this in a hard way?
Yeah, and in fact, it's like other statistics where they don't want to have to deal with it. You know, right now, if you had to list the top five things that HR people have to deal with but they don't want to deal with, it would be, of course, the Affordable Care Act. Dealing with FMLA continues to be a perennial favorite.
The dreaded FMLA.
Right, and then the intersection between the FMLA and, say, pregnancy leave or workers' comp and the like. But right in the top three to five is drug and alcohol use in the workplace, because it's difficult. It's akin to talking to someone about hygiene. When you've got that employee who's got the watery eyes, the slurred speech, the hint of alcohol or the aroma of pot, and there's suspicions, but you're not certain. And then, of course, as you said, David, the issue about privacy. Can I ask them? Can I test them? What if they have a prescription? Gosh, I don't want another lawsuit, and so on.
Yeah, that's really, you know, when we're talking at CMA to clients and they have an issue with an employee, and I'm sure you hear the same thing. HR professionals, business owners, certainly if they don't have HR, all get concerned about the language they use, the words they choose when getting in these situations. That's a real concern for them, and I do understand it.
Yeah, and I think that everyone is gun-shy, and they're afraid about being sued. They're afraid of the perceived-as-disabled claim that typically comes up, you know, and they're afraid of under GINA, Genetic Information Notification Act, and others, they're worried about prying into or finding out too much information. So what happens in the default? There was an article I read recently that said some HR professionals just simply eliminate the job rather than deal with the situation, have a reorganization and layoff, and surprisingly pick the person who they suspect having a drug or alcohol issue, and so on. The other issue that comes up is that the person may be prescribed a medication, and for whatever reason, the alchemy in their system, the way it's working out, or the mixture of drugs that they're taking for an ailment or an injury, are the things that are causing them to have this impairment. And so HR professionals not wanting to deal with that situation because of disability or perceived as disability issues or privacy claims, choose not to deal with it, and they just simply make the benign or neutral choice of, well, we're just eliminating that job or that sales force, or we're going to outsource that function.
You know, the other thing that I hear a lot of, and I'm sure you do, is the decision to test or not test, right? To make that mm-hmm. actual decision. You have just stated that basically it's three times more likely in the states where they have legalized that they actually are now doing more testing. Are you seeing that as a national trend, or is that still something in which, you know, companies are questioning whether or not they should or should not, depending on federal or state laws?
I think more companies are testing, one, because they may be required to do so under federal law, under the Federal Drug-Free Workplace Act, under their own policies. They also may be doing it maybe be directed to do so because of their workers' compensation policy, because some workers' comp policies, if you do not test in cases of certain workplace accidents, you may lose the coverage. Said another way, if you test, you may actually get a break on your premiums. So more and more employers, I think we're seeing, is they're testing. However, they're not doing the testing themselves. They're having medical review officers, MROs. They're sending it out to established clinics, and they're going through, you know, whether it's double blind or other types of testing to be, you know, two panel, five panel tests to be absolutely certain, because you don't want to have a situation where you're accusing someone of being impaired by drugs or alcohol and being wrong. You don't want to be that, you know, that traffic cop who stops someone and having the speed gun tested or the alcohol field sobriety test tested in some way and be embarrassed. And they also didn't want to walk into a lawsuit when the person feels emboldened that you were wrong and you fired me and it must be because about my disability, my age, my gender, and so on. So, yes, more employers are testing than ever before. I spoke on this topic in Las Vegas in June. I asked my audience of some 500 people how many tests. Easily, four-fifths of the audience raised their hand that they test. That is a dramatic increase from in just the last year.
Yeah, I was going to say that's much higher than I had expected you to say. You know, the other issue that comes up is disciplining employees. Because, you know, if an employer hasn't really trained their supervisors, and I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit into the program, but really trained them on what to look for and that there's a standard across the board, you know, it's a suspicion more than anything else, and they get a little bit nervous on how to react on that.
Yeah, and therefore they shouldn't go it alone. I think that supervisors ought to be talking to HR, and HR ought to be talking to their lawyers about what to watch for. Because, again, you may have the situation where someone is not using recreational drugs, illicit drugs, I mean, or not overusing alcohol. It may just simply be that their over-the-counter medication has affected them in a certain way, or something else is going on with their body chemistry. You know, you've got situations with people who are suffering from serious illnesses that take a whole host of drugs, these cocktails, and at different times it affects them different ways. Now, that being said, again, going back to the safety issue or the quality issue and the like, can an employer step in and say, I think you've got a situation here that we should be addressing, but everyone has to be different. In fact, the Americans with Disabilities Act says you must have an individualized assessment of what's going on. And, of course, going back to the ADA in 2009 with its amendments, even though someone may be suffering a serious illness and it may be in remission, they're still treated as being disabled. So the next question you ask is, that's fine. Assuming they're disabled, let's talk about whether or not they can perform the essential functions of their job with or without reasonable accommodation. And that's the way to proceed. But if you have this, and I just had this example the other day, an employee was picked up for erratic driving, and the police officer stopped the person, did a field sobriety test, and the person was arrested for driving under the influence of drugs and or alcohol because she actually had these things in her system. And the supervisor, well-intending, talked to the person, and he was a recovering alcoholic. And he said, you know, look, if you get into a treatment program like I did and you need to go through and do some self-examination. If you go through that process, don't worry. Your job is guaranteed. So when you come out of that, you'll be fine. Well, he made all sorts of promises without knowing the facts and also without checking with HR. Now that the story evolved into the person didn't come back to work. Her job is outside sales. She's lost her license. She won't be arraigned for another month, and nobody's heard from her. The job's not being performed. And yet there was a pushback, and she is not, by the way, she has not checked into recovery or treatment yet. And the supervisor's left with, now he's angry. Wait a minute, she's not here, I want to fire her. But he also is the same person that made promises of, you're guaranteed to be reinstated to your job. So that's a long way of saying supervisors don't go it alone, whether it's detecting suspicion, being suspicious of, or doing an internal investigation, informal or otherwise. Don't go it alone. Always involve HR.
We're talking with Jim Reedy, attorney at Sheehan Finney, Bass & Green. We're going to leave you with a quick random quiz. What industries/professions in the U.S. have the highest prevalence of illicit drug use? By the way, it isn't Congress. A, medical, dental. B, professional sports. C, construction. D, judges on Dancing with the Stars. We'll be right back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB and presented by cmacareer.com. Today, we're talking with Jim Reedy. He is an attorney at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. We're talking about drugs and alcohol in the workplace. And we left the show with a random quiz. Which industries, professions in the U.S. have the highest prevalence of illicit drug use? And again, I'll repeat, it's not Congress. A, medical dental. B, professional sports. C, construction. D, judges on Dancing with the Stars. Well, you know what, Jim? I'm going to pick D, but then again, I have to be careful. My wife loves that show.
Likewise. And if we're not watching Home and Garden television as to what house to flip or where Caribbean destination to move to, we're watching Dancing with the Stars or The Voice. So I understand. But I also believe that you should probably have a drink or two if you're going to be sitting watching those shows. But that's just my own personal opinion.
Juice, of course. Juice.
There you go.
Yes. So obviously the answer is C, construction.
That's correct. And I think that the issue there is, again, going back to the safety issue, if we're talking about the highest prevalence of illicit drug use in the construction industry, the question is how you deal with that situation, both in the pre-screening process, the recruitment process, but also monitoring workers because of the issue, not only of the quality of their work, but also the likelihood that if they are impaired, they could be putting themselves in jeopardy or the safety of others.
So let's get into the drug testing itself, because there are obviously different types of tests. There are some that are performed for federal workers. There are some performed in terms of what individual companies want to do. Kind of give us an overview of what you're seeing and what would be recommendations in terms of different tests for organizations to think about.
Sure. So, I mean, one of the first things to say by way of foundation is that there are no comprehensive federal laws governing drug testing in the private sector. There are some federal laws that require drug and alcohol testing in some industries, and those include transportation, thankfully, whether we're talking about airlines or
truck drivers, right?
Truck drivers, yeah. Especially, railroad conductors and the like. Defense industry workers, healthcare, and mental health workers. That would be under the Federal Drug-Free Workplace Act or related statutes. But there are many more state and local laws dealing with workplace drug and alcohol tests. And I think the comment you made at the outset, David, is it is very, very different from state to state as to what is permitted, what is required, and what are the restrictions on drug and alcohol testing. And it is amazing how different they are, even within the New England states, how different they are.
Yeah, there's no question. It's also not only the test, but what gets reported and how they want it reported. There's also that difference in terms of
absolutely.
Well.
So the different types of tests, and some would be, we could probably name off right away, and others are a little bit more obscure. So urinalysis or urine test, blood test, saliva and breath test, hair samples, and so on. So, and the other is simple observation. You see the person stumbling down the corridor, and you know, smelling of alcohol or pot. You can make that that is effectively a test using your sight, smell, and sound. But the more certain and to remove doubt would be to test urine, blood, saliva, breath test, or hair sample. And each has its own issues associated with it.
So let's go through what would be the advantages of testing.
So one of the advantages of the testing certainly would be, if it's done and done properly, let's talk about Major League Sports. Once baseball talked about doing random testing, they said that, you know, the number of instances of what they believed were abuse dropped significantly, although, you know, any rule you have, there's always someone that does a workaround. But improved productivity and attendance, improved safety and reduction of workplace accidents, ensuring the safety of the public as well and also the quality of the goods and services you produce, minimize the liability and risk of the employer, the reputational risk of the employer. You've got that situation where an employee may be impaired and causes harm to others. And if you reduce that risk, you reduce the risk to the company as well. And then deterrence. And going back to the example of Major League Sports, when you've got a situation where you say, we could test at any time, random testing, the likelihood of someone taking a chance with using during the work week or even on the weekend is reduced significantly. Other advantages would be just reducing your insurance costs, reducing theft and shrinkage. And you say, well, where does that come from? Well, if someone is drug impaired, they're likely to be searching for their next fix or possibility and therefore might steal from the employer, whether it's money or goods, might fund that enterprise. And then, again, reducing the potential for workplace violence as well. And it also helps identify employees that are in need of EAP or other assistance.
You know, I just wanted to drop back for a second. You talked about random sampling, and you also talked about how the states are so different, even within here in New England, whereas Maine and New Hampshire have different opinions on random sampling, whether you can random test for drugs. Is it a concern when you have a company that maybe covers both states and how you handle that?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And, of course, we're the barriers or borders between states or even now between nations are of course, reduced. And so you have a much more mobile workforce because of telecommuting or otherwise, or companies just their reach is broader. But in the New England states, especially when you talk about the contiguous New England states, I mean, you have an issue where somebody may live in Maine and work in New Hampshire or even work in Massachusetts. Someone may live in New Hampshire and could easily commute to Vermont or Maine or Massachusetts and so on, but the laws are in each state different. Employers in Maine have a very different legal landscape with regard to testing than they do in New Hampshire. So just those two neighboring states are very different in that regard, and so employers who have operations in those states who will be testing, and there will be consequences, meaning discipline or not hiring someone or terminating their employment, ought to know what the legal landscape is. First of all, they ought to know if they're covered by federal law. And then secondly, even if they're not covered by federal law, what state laws apply.
We've talked about the advantages of testing. There are risks, though, aren't there?
Yeah, and the risks are, and we started to allude to some of those earlier, privacy concerns and invasion of privacy, the potential impact on employee morale. If you feel like your employer is always looking over your shoulder, whether it's looking at your email, listening in on your phone calls, dropping by your office, dropping by your workstation, and at any point they could say, come down to the conference room, we'll be taking a blood sample, or you'll have to pee in a cup, and so on. That can affect morale. There's no question about that. The problem with the very real possibility of false negatives or false positives, and I think, as I said earlier, the drug testing does not always determine the level of impairment or if it's current drug use. And in that regard, you know, someone who smoked pot episodically or rarely, it shows up, in a matter of days and sometimes a little bit longer than that. If someone's a chronic pot user, then it can stay in their system for much longer. And the person may not be impaired, but it still shows up in their system, either through a urine sample or blood sample or a hair sample. And then there are issues arising under state law. By way of example, in New York and Colorado, you cannot be disciplined for outside work activities that are lawful. So what does that mean? So if it's lawful in Colorado to partake in recreational marijuana, state law says I cannot be disciplined for basically my use of that. Now, if I'm impaired, that's a different story, but if it just shows up in the system. Again, what I said before was that's true, but you also have federal law that says it's an illegal substance. And there are a couple of cases right now in Colorado on that point where federal law and state law are at odds.
You know, I think it's important to go through, if we could, the Drug-Free Workplace Act, the federal law. Could you explain it just so that people have an understanding of generally what this means?
Sure. So the Federal Drug-Free Workplace Act applies to all federal contractors with contracts in excess of $100,000. So that's an annual basis that the value of the contract exceeds $100,000. You're then deemed to be a federal contractor. It also applies to federal contracts with individuals, regardless of the amount. So if I'm an individual contractor, I'm providing a training program or I'm providing a service and the like, but I'm an individual, then it applies to me. And then it applies to federal grantees, again, regardless of the amount. So the issue comes up, okay, I'm covered by, because I'm a recipient of federal funds through this contract, in excess of the threshold dollar amount, if that applies. And what does it require? It requires that the covered employer publish and give a policy statement to the employees informing them that it is unlawful to manufacture, distribute, dispense, possess, or use a controlled substance, and it would be a controlled substance that is prohibited. It has a policy statement that talks about the potential penalties for violating the statute and establishes a drug-free awareness program, so an educational program. The employees must notify their employer if they're convicted of a criminal drug violation, so they have an affirmative obligation on the employees to notify their employer, and the employers must notify the contracting agency, the federal agency they're dealing with, within 10 days after receiving notice that the employee has been convicted of a criminal drug charge. And then it goes on to say that it imposes a penalty or requires satisfactory participation in a rehab program by the employee who is convicted of a reportable drug conviction, and it makes the employer must make an ongoing good faith effort to maintain a drug-free workplace act. So that's the, generally speaking, that's the lay of the land with regard to that. So basically, it's not all that different in one regard of that. It just simply says we prohibit the use or possession of, distribution of, or being impaired while at work. What's different is that the employees have an affirmative obligation to report when they've been convicted of a crime, and the employer then has to report it to the agency that they're contracting with.
Again, on the federal side, a lot of employers may not necessarily be federal contractors or subcontractors, but they might have DOT employees.
Right.
So could you explain that a little bit in terms of what their requirements are in terms of that DOT employee? And also, if you would just talk about the fact that how that might affect the employer itself, because you might have non-DOT employees that work for you as well.
Right. So, you know, that's a very good point, because if you've got, so a DOT, Department of Transportation, regulated employers, and that would be employers with contracts that with federal agencies like the FAA, which is the Federal Aviation Administration, or the Federal Highway Administration, the Federal Railway Administration, the U.S. Coast Guard, etc. So if you are covered by, or you as an employer have employees, but you have a contract with one of those federal agencies, you have to look at testing. And where do you test? You test those employees that are in safety-sensitive positions. And those would be things, again, like aviation, rail, transit, motor carrier, pipelines, maritime, and so on. And the testing that is required under the DOT regs is urinalysis. So, and that's what's required. And it also goes on to say that for this year, the FAA requires minimum random testing for 25% of all safety-sensitive positions and 10% of employees for random alcohol testing. So you've got the distinction between those that are in safety-sensitive positions and those that are not. But one of the problems that arises is, how do you determine what's a safety-sensitive position? It's different between DOT and DOD, Department of Defense, and those would be, again, defense contractors, grantees, federal civilian employees, and the required testing of individuals in safety-sensitive jobs, the contractor is responsible for determining who is in a safety-sensitive position.
When you have a contractor making those decisions, do they all follow a same standard? Is there a direct guidelines that they follow?
there are some guidelines that are actually helpful in that regard. It's called the SAMHSA, which is SAMHSA guidelines, and that is the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, and that's a division of HHS. But basically, the SAMHSA guidelines go through certification of laboratories and some assistance in for employers that are covered that talk about how to appoint a independent medical review officer and the process that should be followed. But SAMHSA guidelines give a list of safety-sensitive jobs for which random testing is required. So that does provide some guidance to those covered employers.
We've talked about federal contractors and some of the DOT and DOD requirements, but there are federal laws that apply to most employers when it comes to drug testing and different things. Can you go through a couple of them?
Yeah, so going beyond the narrow scope of those employers that would be covered by federal contracts and therefore be determined to be federal contractors covered by the Federal Drug-Free Workplace Act or the DOT or DOD regulations, the broader scope that applies to more employers would be things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, which applies to all employers in the U.S. that have 15 or more employees. And so that comes into play when you've got situations of where someone is suspected of being under the influence of drugs or alcohol, because the ADA considers certain types of tests to be medical tests, and as such, there's a confidentiality provision that attaches to that. But there are differences, and it's important to point out, there are differences under the ADA between tests for drugs and tests for alcohol.
So when you're talking about the difference between alcohol and drugs, alcohol historically has been treated a little differently because, for example, most companies have policies that say you can be terminated right away for if you come in drunk. I mean, that's not an uncommon thing that you hear in terms of policies and procedures. Well, when it comes to drugs, it's a little bit different. Why is that?
I think because of the uncertainty of whether someone is impaired or not, whether or not they are currently using a prescribed drug, and like I said, you know, it may be some sort of accidental overuse or misuse of the prescribed drug, or it's an illicit drug. And so I think it's cloaked in mystery, whereas alcohol is pretty straightforward. You know, it's been legal since Prohibition ended, and, you know, you pretty much know both the aroma and the effect of alcohol. And also the standards of, apart from the sales dinner, apart from the retirement party or other company function, you really ought not to be drinking alcohol during the day, either coming in with alcohol on your breath or drinking during the day and the like, or overusing at a work function.
We're talking with Jim Reedy, employment attorney at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. We're going to leave you with another quiz here, and it is, how many states have drug alcohol testing laws? A, all 50 states in some form or another, B, 23, C, 44, or D, only a few. They otherwise rely on federal law. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAKorea.com. And today we're talking with the one, the only, Jim Reedy, employment attorney at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green, a great HR Power Hour sponsor. We're really excited to have you on the show today. And, of course, what are we talking about? We're talking about drug testing, drugs in the workplace. We're talking about drugs and alcohol, Jim. What a great topic.
It's a great topic first thing in the morning, for sure.
No question. All right, so we left and we had a random quiz. How many states have drug and alcohol testing laws? The answers were A, all 50 states in some form or another, B, 23, C, 44, or D, only a few. They otherwise rely on federal law. Jim, what's the answer?
Currently, 44 states have some form of drug or alcohol testing laws. And I think the important point to make there is they vary widely between states as to whether testing is prohibited, whether it's restricted or it's encouraged, and what can the consequences be of a positive test.
You know, we were just finishing up the federal side of drug testing. Under the ADA, there is a difference, as you mentioned, between alcohol and drug tests. Could you kind of wrap up the federal side and give us a quick overview?
Yeah, and that's an important point, too, because as we go into the looking at the various states, it's important to see this distinction, which is perhaps because drugs are more sort of unknown or mystical or feared, and whereas alcohol is not. A couple of things that come up under the ADA, and the ADA, again, has been around since 1992, but that, too, is an evolving body of law. And it says that employers cannot ask applicants about their former treatment or counseling with regard to illegal drugs or alcohol. You can't ask them about that because then that person is protected if they've gone through a treatment program and they're considered to be a disabled person. You shouldn't ask about that. You should focus only on current illegal use of drugs. And then you can ask an applicant about their drinking habits. However, the danger with that, and this goes to what you said before, David, about what you ask and how you ask it, is you might elicit information about alcoholism and so on, and alcoholism being a protected disability. So then you move into, okay, if we're prohibiting it by way of policy, meaning the active use of drugs and alcohol in the workplace, can we test? And there's a distinction between drugs and alcohol. Under the ADA, alcohol testing is considered to be a medical exam, and therefore employers may only require employees to submit to a test after that, one that is job-related, and it's consistent with business necessity. In other words, there's no applicant screening for alcohol, generally speaking. Now, it's under the ADA, and it's different under other federal laws with regard to transportation jobs and so on. So it's a medical test. It's got to be job-related. It has to be post-offer, and all the employees in that same position must be tested for alcohol. And you can still conduct random testings for alcohol in safety-sensitive positions, but you can't have a blanket rule of no alcohol off-duty. Now, compare that to drugs very quickly. Testing for illegal drugs under the ADA, it is not treated as a medical exam. So what does that mean? You can test someone pre-offer, a pre-screening. You can do it for all applicants in the same position, but you're not testing for alcohol and you're not testing for prescription drugs. You're only testing for illicit drugs or illegal drugs.
So what I thought we'd do now is kind of go through a few samples of some state drug and alcohol testing laws. We're going to try to do this a little bit in rapid fire so that we can get through a number of them. You up for that, Jim?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's start with your home state, New Hampshire.
So in New Hampshire, there is no general law requiring or prohibiting the use of prohibiting drug testing. We have health care laws arising out of a case involving a health care worker that was using illicit drugs and using needles, and then it was in a cath lab, and there was some very serious issues associated with that. So as a result, health care providers have their own separate drug testing policies, but apart from that, no other employer, unless they're a federally covered contractor, has any drug or alcohol testing issues.
State of Maine, my hometown.
Very interesting. State of Maine, as your listeners know, in the great state of Maine, they have their own unique drug testing policy. It's a very restrictive drug testing policy, which is interesting because New Hampshire is the live free or die state, but but Maine truly is live free or die because it is a very restricted drug testing policy. The policy must be approved by the Maine Department of Labor. It cannot require employees to sign a consent form, which is very interesting to the drug testing. You can't require it. It must be truly voluntary. And the employers over 20 employees must have an EAP program. Stated further, it says that first-time employees who test positive for drugs must be offered the opportunity for 6 months of rehab, either public or private, and if the employer has more than 20 employees, the employer is required to pay for half of the rehab expenses that go beyond what is covered by insurance. And finally, the workforce-related accident that is caused by the employee cannot be the probable cause for testing. So you know, you've got, in many instances, other states, whether covered by federal or state law, if there's a workplace accident that triggers a drug test. In Maine, the first workplace accident cannot trigger the drug test. And for purposes of termination in Maine, you can only terminate someone who receives a second confirmed positive drug test, and or if the employee refuses to participate in a rehab program or EAP program, or if the employee fails to complete the rehab program within 6 months.
How about the great state of Vermont, Green Mountain State?
The Green Mountain State, where you've got pre-employment testing is permitted along with reasonable suspicion testing. However, you must give the employee 10 days advance notice of the intent to test.
That's always one that makes me laugh, Jim. I'm sorry. It just makes me chuckle.
Yeah, and random testing, therefore, is prohibited because, again, you have to give notice in advance. And termination for the first positive test is only when the employee refuses treatment. So this is, I will tell you, this and the Maine statutes are considered to be sort of the leading trend in this area, where employers are looking to retain employees and have a degree of grace or forgiveness with regard to that first positive test.
Well, let's talk about usually the state that has leading trends, California.
And what is sort of counterintuitive here is California, you would think, would be really out there because typically that's where California is. They have a balancing test, which is actually pretty reasonable, which is they look at the balancing of the employee's right to privacy against the employer's need to conduct the test, again, for safety and other issues. They do post-offer testing, but they must test all employees in the same position. You can test current employees based upon reasonable suspicion, and random drug tests are okay with regard to safety-sensitive positions. That, to me, is a well-founded, balanced law.
Well, you know, it's nice to hear that California has won. All right, how about, so let's go to Florida.
Florida. So always an interesting state to look at with for purposes of their law. Employers can test, but they must follow very specific statutory procedures with regard to how they're tested, how the samples are maintained, the chain of custody, who reviews them, and so on. And they must give employees a written policy describing all aspects of the drug and alcohol testing and procedures. And in that regard, if the employer does not specifically follow the very strict statutory construction or their policies, the drug test could be thrown out.
Idaho.
Let's see. The potato state. So drug and alcohol testing permitted, but they have to follow very specific guidelines. And the first test, just like Maine and others, you get sort of a pass. But what's interesting about that, a positive test will automatically result in the denial of the employees if the person's terminated for the positive test. Unemployment benefits denied in the state of Idaho.
So the last one we're going to do is Virginia.
Virginia's interesting because it's similar to New Hampshire in that regard. It's permitted for all employers, but it's sort of wide open. It is required for certain professions when there is an accident reported, coal miners and others, and local school boards can require drug testing for bus drivers, which is, of course, a very good public policy.
We're talking with Jim Brady, employment attorney at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. I've got one more random quiz for the audience. What former U.S. presidents farmed hemp? That's right. What former U.S. presidents farmed hemp? A, Thomas Jefferson. B, James Madison. C, George Washington. D, Jimmy Carter. Or E, all but Carter, because hemp and peanuts don't mix. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. We're talking with Jim Reedy, and he is an employment attorney with Sheehan Finney Bass and Green. The last question we left with were, which former U.S. presidents farmed hemp? A, Thomas Jefferson, B, James Madison, C, George Washington, D, Jimmy Carter, or E, all but Carter, hemp and peanuts don't mix. I love these quizzes, Jim. So what's the answer?
The answer is E. It's all but Carter. Those former U.S. presidents, Jefferson, Madison, and Washington, all farmed hemp. It was a very common product. It's a common element, of course, in rope and other products, but it also is a common element. It's the plant for marijuana.
Well, you know, you learn something new every day. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about the legal, you know, considerations for private employers. Is there anything else you just want to add to that?
Yeah, I think there are a couple things. I think that you know, you want to look at your state law to determine whether or not you have things like, if I test for drugs and alcohol, whether there's an immunity with regard to certain lawsuits related to the drug test. Alaska, Arizona, Idaho, and Utah offer that. Some states provide workers' compensation premium discounts. Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Ohio, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia. And there are other issues as well. I think that you, whatever test you use, you ought to be following a very specific policy and guidelines. Again, don't do it alone. Use an established clinic that will do it. Have chain of custody and records and the like. Don't have supervisors sending people off to the bathroom to pee in a cup and so on. That it's a very straightforward policy. And again, you're certain that under applicable federal and state laws that you're following the guidelines. And also, if you're a unionized workforce, you're making certain that you follow what your union agreement says.
Well, you know, we're going to end this show. We have about 2 minutes left. Where are we going with this whole drug issue here in 2015-16?
God knows. I think if you were to say 5 years ago that we'd be looking at four states now where that marijuana was legal, I think you'd get very few HR professionals that would agree with that or think that that was going to be a reality. That nearly 30 states have medical marijuana that is approved. There are still those battles between federal and state law as to enforcement of federal law, what employers can rely upon. I think what we're finding is, the trend is decriminalizing for sure, but also having employers being able to enforce their work rules with regard to attendance or the quality of the product and the like, and also to limit liability. There's no question that we have a culture that is, whether it's drugs, prescription drugs, illicit drugs, or alcohol, it's more prevalent, and employers are fighting the tide against that, trying to, again, protect their employees and the quality of their product. I think what's interesting is we're going to see more guidance with regard to the battle between federal and state laws, and I think you'll find employers even being more strict with regard to testing. It's a brave new world, as you said, Dave, and I think that employers just ought to be on guard and make certain that they're complying with all applicable laws as they continue to evolve.
We've been speaking with Jim Reedy. He's the attorney, chair, labor, and employment law group at Sheehan Finney Bass and Green. Jim, I really appreciate you being on the show today. I appreciate your organization being an HR Power Hour sponsor. This was a great topic today, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.